running out of options, and in the current situation, it may inch closer to Turkey, Qatar, Iran, and more particularly to China, to offset pressure from Saudi Arabia and UAE, which are strengthening their alliance with Israel, US, and India. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis-sabri was-salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Today we listen to the speech of Hujjatul Islam Salim Yusuf Ali.
We talked about the concept of doing dhulm to others and observing the rights of people and the rights of believers. But there's one portion of this discussion that is missing, and that I'd like to address briefly tonight. And that is the topic of doing dhulm to one's self. It's a topic which is mentioned a lot in the Quran. And it's done in a way where definitely Allah Ta'ala is encouraging us to reflect upon the deeper nature of injustice. And tonight we want to take the lesson of justice from Imam Hussein alayhi salam. So I want to talk about it in the context of doing dhulm to oneself. I want to start, like previous nights, by looking at the book of Allah. Allah in the Quran describes the story of Bani Israel. Bani Israel had just been saved from the Pharaoh. The sea had been parted from them. They had crossed safely. Pharaoh and his army were drowned, and they came across idol worshippers. And they were very impressed by the worship of their idol. And so they tell Nabi Musa alayhi salam that, can you make us like a god, a physical god that we can worship like those people are worshiping? And of course, that is an act of injustice on the level of creed and belief. Nabi Musa encourages them to have tawheed, to worship only God. Now, in the sequence of events that then take place, Nabi Musa alayhi salam has to leave his people, and he puts Harun alayhi salam in charge. And Allah Ta'ala describes in Surah Al-Baqarah how when Nabi Musa leaves, there are opportunists who are seeking to take advantage of the situation, and they know that the people were impressed by those idols, so they say that this is our perfect time to strike, and we're going to cause disunity in the society. One of them is somebody named Samiri. Samiri was very skilled in handicraft, and so he made a statue of a cow that would make a mooing sound, and he called the people of Israel to worship this cow. And many of them, they started to do so. They accepted his invitation. They abandoned Nabi Harun. Others knew that this was wrong, but they felt like that there's no point in doing Amar bil Ma'ruf and Nahi an Munkar, so they neglected that duty of theirs. And Nabi Musa alayhi salam, after being gone for 40 days, he returns back to his people. He's very disappointed with them. But Allah Ta'ala still has hope for these people. And he commands Nabi Musa alayhi salam to address them, and he says to them, Ya Qawmi, O my people, إِنَّكُمْ ظَلَمْتُمْ أَنفُسَكُمْ بِاتِّخَاذِكُمُ الْعِجْلِ فَتُوبُوا إِلَىٰ بَارِئِكُمْ. You have committed an act of injustice against yourselves by taking this calf, this golden calf, as an object of worship. So repent to the one who created you. Notice how Nabi Musa addresses them. He says that you have done dhulm to yourselves by taking this idol as an object of worship. This expression is something which appears many times in the Quran. When Allah wants to describe somebody who commits any type of act of injustice, whether it be at the level of belief, whether it be by trampling somebody's rights, whether it be that they're a dictator or an oppressor, Allah says that you have done injustice to yourself. إِنَّمَا بَغْيُكُمْ عَلَىٰ أَنفُسِكُمْ. In one verse, he says that when you're doing baghi and you're trampling on the rights of others, you're actually doing dhulm to yourself. In another verse where Allah is talking about the relationship between spouses, and he talks about a certain type of injustice that can be done where the husband doesn't observe the rights of the wife, he says that whoever does this, فَقَدْ ظَلَمَ نَفْسَ. Even though it might seem like he's oppressing her, he's actually oppressing himself. Now, this is an important concept for us to understand. And we know that the Quran is not just a book of the past, it's a book of the present as well. And every ummah had its Samiri. Every ummah had its prophet. Just like Nabi Musa appointed Harun as his successor, we know that our prophet appointed Imam Ali as his successor. And we know that just like people abandon Harun en masse, we know that people abandon Imam Ali Islam en masse as well too. And so if we go and look and see what was the cause of people abandoning Nabi Harun, it was the fact that they did dhulm to themselves. So then we can deduce that the reason why people abandoned Imam Hussein Ali Islam, they abandoned Imam Ali before him and then Imam Hussein, is because they did dhulm to themselves. So it's good for us to explore this topic of doing dhulm to oneself. And why is it so emphasized in the teachings of the Quran and the Ahlul Bayt alayhi wasalam? This self, the nafs, is something which is a creation of Allah. Allah in the Quran, when He describes the creation of the human being, He says that there's three stages of development within the mother's womb, from the drop to the embryo to the fetus. But then Allah says that as part of this process, ثُمَّ جَعَلْنَاهُ خَلْقًا آخَرٍ, that we make this creation some other type of creation. فَتَبَارَكَ اللَّهُ أَحْسَنُ الْخَالِقِينَ, and the best of creator is Allah. In another verse, Allah says, وَنَفَخْتُ فِيهِ مِنْ رُوحِ, I breathe into this being from my soul. Okay, now this expression, of course, it doesn't mean something physical, and sometimes Allah, when He wants to talk about how special something is, whether it be His house or whether it be His prophet or whatever, He uses the word my. And when you look at the verses about the human soul, we see that this is something which is prized and a precious creation of Allah Ta'ala. And the teachings of the Quran tell us that when somebody is doing dhulm, on the surface level, it might seem that they're striking out and they're hurting somebody, or they're, you know, taking away the rights of somebody or a group of people, but actually they're doing dhulm to themselves. And some of the great scholars, they've said that actually when somebody does any act of displacing someone's rights or they're committing a sin, actually the one that they do dhulm to primarily is themselves. And the other people they do dhulm to is actually a shadow of the dhulm that they do to themselves. There's a very beautiful hadith of Imam Ali al-Islam in Nahj al-Balagha. He says that يَوْمُ الْمَظْلُومِ عَلَى الظَّالِمِ أَشَدُّ مِنْ يَوْمِ الظَّالِمِ عَلَى الْمَظْلُومِ, which means that the day in which the oppressed will take revenge over the oppressors is more severe than the day in which the oppressors are doing oppression over the oppressed. Okay, there's 2 days. There's one time where the oppressors are doing oppression, another time when the oppressed will seek their revenge. Now, there's a simple understanding of that, which is to say that, okay, well, there'll come a day where, you know, there'll be justice and Allah will, you know, obviously, you know, call people to task for all the sins that they committed. But there's a deeper understanding of that, which is that when somebody is committing an act of injustice, at the most, the person that they're harming is going to be harmed for the span of, like, let's say one lifetime, like in this world. And it can be very serious, right? But it's one lifetime and it's limited to this world. But in the spiritual dimension, when they are committing this act of injustice, whether it be a sin against God, whether it be violating somebody's rights, whether it be an act of oppression in the society, on a spiritual level, they are harming themselves in a way that it could last for eternity. So of the two, which one is more severe? It's the harm that they're causing to themselves. And so that's why when it comes to this concept of dhulm, we have to understand that fundamentally, dhulm and oppression starts with one doing oppression to themselves.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Kareemun Azim Alimun Halim Hakimun Mateen شكورٌ ودود قيومٌ رؤوف صبورٌ مجيد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمن
In the limelight.
Geoengineering has been debated since the 1960s when U.S. scientists suggested floating billions of white golf ball-like objects in the oceans to reflect sunlight. Interfering in natural processes was widely considered naive and dangerous until recently. But as the window to curb global warming shrinks, proposals to reflect sunlight, shade Earth's surface, accelerate carbon absorption in the oceans, and remove CO2 from the air are being taken more seriously. In October, Silver Lining, a non-profit organization, gave $3 million towards climate engineering research. Silver Lining's grant recipients are researching whether humans can blast sunlight-reflecting aerosol particles into the stratosphere, mimicking the cooling effect of volcanic ash clouds. In 1991, Mount Pinatubo in the Philippines erupted, spewing sulfate particles into the atmosphere that caused global temperatures to drop 0.6 degrees Celsius over the next 2 years. Solar radiation management would involve sending fleets of aeroplanes up to 65,000 feet, where they'll spray sulfate aerosols into the upper atmosphere, or perhaps even diamond dust. A research team at Harvard University projects that if high-altitude tankers had the capacity to make 60,000 particle dumps by 2035, it would shave off 0.3 degrees Celsius off global warming. We now present you an article written by staff writers of The Week magazine under the heading, Should Scientists Artificially Cool the Planet to Stave Off Climate Catastrophe? Please stay with us for more. Scientists artificially cool the planet to stave off climate catastrophe. Here's everything you need to know. What is geoengineering? Some climate scientists are coming to believe it's humanity's only hope for slowing down or stopping disastrous changes in the climate. A runaway carbon dioxide emissions contribute to melting ice caps, widespread flooding, prolonged heat waves and droughts, apocalyptic wildfires, and devastating hurricanes. Researchers are exploring planetary-scale interventions in Earth's natural systems as a way of counteracting climate change. Geoengineering has been debated since the 1960s when U.S. scientists suggested floating billions of white, golf ball-like objects in the oceans to reflect sunlight. Interfering in natural processes was widely considered naive and dangerous until recently. But as the window to curb global warming shrinks, proposals to reflect sunlight, shade Earth's surface, accelerate carbon absorption in the oceans, and remove carbon dioxide from the air are being taken seriously. In October, Silver Lining, a non-profit organization, gave $3 million towards climate engineering research. Michael Gerard, a professor of environmental and climate law at Columbia University in New York, said, "I liken geoengineering to chemotherapy," he added. "If all else is failing, you try it." But what are the most plausible proposals? Silver Linings grant recipients are researching whether humans can blast sunlight-reflecting aerosol particles into the stratosphere, mimicking the cooling effect of volcanic ash clouds. In 1991, Mount Pinatubo in the Philippines erupted, spewing sulfate particles into the atmosphere that caused global temperatures to drop 0.6 degrees Celsius over the next 2 years. Solar radiation management would involve sending fleets of aeroplanes up into the air to 65,000 feet, where they'd spray sulfate aerosols into the upper atmosphere, or perhaps even spray diamond dust. A research team at Harvard University projects that if high-altitude tankers had the capacity to make 60,000 particle dumps by 2035, it would shave off 0.3 degrees Celsius of global warming. But what else is being explored? Another idea is to pump salt water from the oceans into the air, forming water droplets that would make marine clouds brighter and thus more reflective. Australia is funding research, hoping enhanced clouds could cool water temperatures enough to save the already damaged Great Barrier Reef. Researchers at Cambridge University in Britain are studying whether ships can pump salt particles into low-lying polar clouds to help refreeze polar ice caps. Other researchers wonder whether seeding oceans with iron could stimulate the growth of marine algae, which soaks up carbon dioxide from the air. For now, solar radiation management is thought to be scientifically the sturdiest candidate. Dr. Douglas McMartin at Cornell University engineer says, "We know with 100% certainty that we can cool the planet." So why not do it now? Well, meddling with Mother Nature is risky. Earth's weather systems are interconnected in extremely complex ways, which is why climate change is believed to impact everything from how long hurricanes linger over coastlines to how fast wildfires accelerate. Tinkering with one aspect of weather could have dangerous unforeseen ripple effects. 2 years ago, Nature magazine called geoengineering outlandish and unsettling. For example, could blocking sunlight impact the Asian monsoon season, which 2 billion people depend on for food crops, or alter the ocean's acidity? For geoengineering to be politically feasible, scientists would have to convince ordinary people that it's worth the calculated risk. Last year, Harvard University sought to send a balloon into the stratosphere over Tucson, Arizona, in order to release small amounts of calcium carbonate or chalk to test whether the reflective particles could block some sunlight, but public outcry forced the experiment to be postponed. But is safety the only concern? Well, no. Some climate activists argue that geoengineering serves as a get-out-of-jail-free panacea that would allow carbon-emitting corporations to conduct business as usual. They argue that no technological breakthroughs would eliminate the long-term need to abandon fossil fuels. Raymond Pierre Humbert, a Nobel Prize-winning professor at Oxford University, compares relying on geoengineering without cutting carbon dioxide emissions to jumping off the Washington Monument and hoping somebody invests anti-gravity before you hit the ground. Where do most scientists stand on this? While the global failure to make major emission cuts is causing many experts to reconsider geoengineering. Compared with the massive financial consequences of global warming, the estimated $2 billion annual price tag to develop solar engineering over the next 15 years is quite inexpensive. In March, the Australian team conducted one of the world's first geoengineering trials, using 100 nozzles to enhance existing clouds by blasting salt water into the air. In theory, it would take about 1,000 nozzles to save the entire Great Barrier Reef from dying off. Harvard University professor David Keith says, "People are right to fear over-reliance on techno-fixes," he added, "but there's another nightmare. We realize in hindsight that early use of geoengineering could have saved millions of lives lost in heat waves and helped preserve some of the natural world." How about sucking carbon out of the air? The United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change said the world must remove 1 trillion tons of carbon by 2100, or have any hope of avoiding more than 1.5 degrees Celsius of global warming. A proposed solution, carbon capture, takes two forms. Removing carbon dioxide directly from the emissions of power plants and other industrial facilities, or scrubbing it from the atmosphere. At least 19 large-scale projects worldwide are working to capture carbon dioxide from smokestacks at coal or natural gas power plants. Such a system was created in 2017 at a Texas coal plant, but shut down this May because it captured just 17% of carbon dioxide emissions, not the target of 33%. The more ambitious plan for carbon capture involves installing pipes to suck carbon from the sky, then store it deep underground. Several companies have developed technology to do just that, but the process remains more expensive. Stripe, a startup company, enables companies and individuals to contribute money to fund carbon dioxide removal as a means of getting the technology off the ground. Nan Ransohoff, the head of Stripe Climate, told The Atlantic magazine, "This is a hardware problem. It's an infrastructure problem. It's a science problem." Ransohoff added, "It takes a long time to develop carbon removal. This is not Snapchat."
Join us in this journey, IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Iran today.
In Iran, you see restaurants serving unlimited amounts of bread next to whatever meal one might order. And the yogurt and cheese to go with the bread don't normally come plain. Rose petal, pistachios, and walnuts blend well if you know how to apply them.
Correct. We are here to talk about Iran's agricultural resources today. Agricultural sustainability and independence, rather, in the face of U.S. maximum pressure sanctions. Because, yes, the sanctions are still in place, and they're even affecting food and drug availability. Stay with me, Leila Faromanzi, on Iran Today to see how Iran, this mini-continent of four seasons, is doing. Iran's present situation is fine for the short term, but longer-term planning is a must to maintain and improve suitable arable water levels and soil quality, foreign policy, and people's purchasing power. Disjointed as these factors may sound, they all come together to make for foodstuff availability and security, and a lucrative food industry. Mr. Kiani Rad is in a position to plan strategy for the country's agricultural sector and market. He explains the tenets of a successful chain, beginning with production and ending in consumption.
Food security has four main pillars. The first pillar of the debate is availability, meaning that food must be available in the required amount. It goes without saying that the agricultural sector needs resources and agricultural components to produce food, perhaps the most important of which are basic resources such as soil, water, biodiversity, and other factors of production, including the productive components, machinery, and so on.
Aye, for as long as produce is delivered to the market on time and not hoarded to raise prices, and for as long as people can afford it, there still is enough crop yielded to keep stomachs full and keep Iranian cuisine alive. The FAO announced the production of over 21.5 million tons of grain in Iran during the last crop year, and announced that Iran is ranked 9th in the world in terms of grain reserves. Achieving this rank while the country is exposed to drought is commendable. With 17th place in terms of population in the world, Iran has 1.1% of the world's grain reserves. Mr. Khalilian is a former agriculture minister. He has some figures handy to present.
Fortunately, during the 4 decades since the Islamic Republic was founded, we have been able to meet more than 80% of our agricultural needs in food. Especially on products such as wheat, we have managed to become relatively self-sufficient for some years. In the years when we faced drought, we met at least 80% of our wheat needs from the inside. In the field of dairy products, rice, and some other strategic products, we have been able to achieve relative self-sufficiency and even managed to export $5 to $6 billion a year in various agricultural products.
The wheat harvest has actually decreased by 500,000 tons in the last crop year. However, the rice harvest has increased by 200,000 tons and other grains have grown by 200,000 tons as well. Iran's staple diet is wheat, barley, and rice. Ms. Rafi saves room for praise for improvement. She's on the Parliamentary Agricultural Committee and has the qualification to amend the legal system to improve Iran's status in the sector.
Unfortunately, we are over 70% dependent on inputs. This is not called strategic agriculture for a country. When we have to import seeds, when we have to import pesticides and fertilizers, to a large extent, we have to import livestock and fish feed inputs. This means incomplete and improper planning in the field of agriculture.
The United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization, FAO, had estimated the area under wheat cultivation in Iran would increase slightly in 2020. Plantation area is around 6 million hectares right now. Iran is basically on the Iranian plateau and is at high altitude. The country comprises 14% arable land, 8% forest, and 55% natural pastures, and 23% desert. The pastures are non-arable, by the way.
One of the major projects undertaken in the Islamic Republic was the Agricultural Development Project, which we have been pursuing since 2010. We provided 9 trillion tomans of cheap credits and facilities to farmers, and we also help new investors to invest in various fields with low-interest facilities.
In March 2020, the government announced its plans to purchase nearly 75% of the domestic wheat production. The aim was to eliminate the reliance on imports for domestic consumption. With all the talk of domestic consumption, it's easy to lose sight of the importance of exports. Now, sanctions may well be in the way of exports, and what a shame, given Iran's high-quality, varied produce. Before going on to exports, however, I would like to tend more to the importance of improving the farming and agriculture sector. That can be helped by foreign investment and introducing more technology into farming in Iran. Having managed, followed and managed water resources, however. As per any sector, exports must move, however, from raw sales to the sale of processed material and standardly packed, preferably organic foodstuff and food products. Mr. Sheikhi is an economist who can list as many impediments to exports as there are letters in the alphabet. Here are some of those reasons.
Unfortunately, Iran has a very small share in the global agricultural market, which is also a lucrative one. This is because, unfortunately, we have not, and still do not have, an integrated trade policy system based on the model of a resistive economy. I will mention some of the problems here on a case-by-case basis. One of the problems is bureaucracy. The second is a lack of coordination between organs. And furthermore, we don't have a specific body that is responsible for the export of agricultural products.
The government had wanted to attract $8 billion over 4 years by foreign investment in the agricultural sector. That was before the 2015 JCPOA or nuclear deal, which would have facilitated just that by lifting sanctions off Iran in return for this country limiting its peaceful nuclear program. But before the contents of the deal could materialize, the U.S. pulled out and reimposed and reinforced economic nuclear-related U.N. sanctions as U.S. sanctions.
Foreign investment in our country has not been very successful. There are several reasons for that, some of which are internal and others external and out of our control. Internal reasons include the problem of bureaucratic processes in the country, which makes it somewhat difficult to invest. I can use the term self-sanctioning to describe it. The issue of foreign sanctions has also had its impacts. More important than sanctions is the issue of investment security and the feeling of investment security. We are the safest country in the Middle East. Some admit this, some do not. But the media propaganda tries to undermine the perception of this security.
As for exports again, Iran's share in the international market is pretty low in spite of its present resources and future potential. Its share in the global market is at under 5%. FAO says threats should be turned around into opportunities to turn small-scale farming into macro farming. The infrastructure, after all, is present given Iran's variety of terrains, which make for four seasons to exist simultaneously. They also make for a varied influx of produce all the year round.
We're at the crossroads of the north, south, and east-west trade corridors. This crossroads can be a special place for us in exporting products that are cultivated and created through investment in our country. Energy is abundant in this country. We have a lot of renewable energy. In addition to being one of the world's leading oil and gas producers and having huge reserves, we have renewable energy that can be used organically without generating pollution and with the lowest pollution costs to serve the production and investment. We also have a large and young workforce.
Talking of infrastructure, Iran's Qanat irrigated agricultural heritage systems made Iran the most fertile area in the history of Asia. There was once mass production of grains as well as sugarcane and date palm. And today, just in 2004, Iran's wheat yield reached 14 million tons. This made the country more than self-sufficient as far as land yield goes. It ended the country's 45-year history of importing wheat. Also, it saved the country $1 billion a year in overseas expenditures. Iran may have lost the European market in spite of the high quality of its exports, but it is still exporting to countries such as Iraq, Azerbaijan, and Afghanistan. Iran is the world's biggest producer of pistachio and saffron. Apart from those two products, exports of other agricultural commodities like apples, milk, and vegetables are not economically viable for Iranian exporters. Regarding Iran's agricultural resources, what they entail, and what more must be done about them, there's more to be said. But first, a media review with Shahrzad.
Hi, my name is Shahrzad Manoucheri, and we'll be reviewing the latest update on food security amid sanctions, Iran's untapped agricultural potentials. In an article by Tehran Times, we explore soil depletion, a neglected issue requiring urgent attention. Soil is one of the most vital non-renewable resources that many organisms on the planet depend on, as it ensures food security of the nations. However, the attention paid to this valuable resource is not as much as its significance. According to the latest statistics, Iran loses 2 billion tons of soil annually, which according to the 2018 report of the United Nations Development Program, the total amount of global soil erosion is 24 billion tons, so 1/12 of all global soil erosion occurs in Iran. This is while Iran has about 1% of the world's land area, which means that its erosion rate is 8 times higher than the global average, so Iran is suffering from severe degradation and soil erosion. To understand the importance of soil protection, it should be said that it takes an average of 400 years to form a centimeter of soil on the planet. Forty Daily reports Iran's food self-sufficiency reaches 81%. Qasem Pahlavi, acting Minister of Agriculture of Iran, said, "For the coming year, we have seen the supply of all inputs such as seeds, fertilizers, pesticides, and livestock and poultry supplements, vaccines and serums, and a good work environment." He also added that we have a very close relationship with farmers, and the wheat cultivation program is 6% more than that of last year, and barley cultivation is 16% higher than last year, and rapeseed cultivation is 14% higher than last year. He then added, our self-sufficiency in the food production reached 81% last year, and our forecast is that this number will increase and reach 83% this year, thanks to the efforts of farmers. Tehran Times states Persian Gulf Water Transfer Project inaugurated. In recent years, due to increasing water consumption for drinking, industrial and agricultural purposes, and sometimes consecutive droughts, the central plateau of Iran has been experiencing severe water shortages, especially in big cities like Isfahan, Kerman, Yazd, and Hormozgan. President Hassan Rouhani inaugurated the first phase of Iran's major water desalination and transfer project, which is aimed at supplying Persian Gulf water to central Iran through pipelines. This project is aimed at transmitting Persian Gulf water to Hormozgan, Kerman, and Yazd provinces after being desalinated in a modern desalination plant. With the implementation of this project, the country's desalination capacity is going to increase by 50%. This project aims to promote production, industry, and agriculture, as well as to provide drinkable water to residents in arid areas. Maintaining the country's food security and creating new job opportunities, and also maintaining the already existing jobs in industrial and production units, are also other merits of the mentioned project. That's all for this segment. We'll see you next week.
In general, Iran's major agricultural exports include fresh and dried fruits, nuts, animal hide, processed foods, caviar, and spices. From the standpoint of value, pistachio, raisins, dates, and saffron are the first four export products. On the relatively new bell pepper farm you've seen me in so far, I got to talk to the farmer who set up his business with a look to exports as well as domestic supply.
From the beginning, I looked at the market, and in Iran nowadays, this product is consumed better, and it is also against the some kind of cancers. So we have to have it in our food, I think. We are exporting more than half of our products to, for example, Russia and in the Persian Gulf region. I think 10% is for domestic use and 90% for export.
A danger to both self-sufficiency and exports that bring foreign currency into the country is unaccounted for imports and exports. That is to say, when people's most basic need becomes a source of astronomical income to the few, and the balance between these three variables is tipped over. Imports, exports, and domestic produce for domestic use.
Our Ministry of Industry, Mining and Trade is structured so that it's more willing to import in this regard. The desire to import is extremely high. The interests of many traders dominating the country's markets and product supply hinder the development of exports. There are some brokers who are mainly looking for imports because that's how they generate money. Being able to attain licensing for imports and exports is a public right. It must not be given to just a select few. Licenses must be granted to productive cooperatives.
The agricultural sector's share in Iran's non-oil gross domestic product, GDP, reached 8.8% in the previous Iranian calendar year. That's up 3% over 7 years. Once again, the Iranian calendar year begins on March the 21st. There is room for more growth in the agriculture sector, however, by using modern science and new technologies and methods, both technically and in the commercial sector.
In two ways, I think we are going forward. One of them is academical studies, and these academical studies helps us to become a farmer, because I'm not a farmer's son. I'm only an agriculture engineer, but I decided to make this. And the other thing is the sanctions, I think, because these sanctions causes us to pushes us to do it by ourselves.
Now, in spite of all the talk on mechanizing or further modernizing farming, the gardening business, as one branch of the industry, boasts it has mechanized enough to have produced more crop at higher quality and lower, more competable costs. The agricultural sector at large, however, must become more demand-orientated than supply-orientated in order to make better engineered profit from sales. This is although Iran claims over 95% of the technology and knowledge in this area, that's mechanization, is domestic. A shortcoming for the country is the agricultural industry falls short of raw material production, be it growing grain and fruit or husbanding cattle and farming fish. Gardening has contributed significantly to non-oil exports and creating employment. With an evolved related industry, including packaging methods, it can do yet better.
The ground for attracting foreign investment for agricultural development is provided. Foreigners can make good profits if they invest in fields such as packaging, processing of agricultural products, and many other areas. The point is that Iran is a secure country, and I think investors should take that into consideration. Iranian government guarantees their original capital and the profit thereof.
Now we can toil all we want, but with climate change and population growth, and now a viral pandemic at large, planning is key to carrying on. Crops and the sustenance and money they secure can only be guaranteed by the health of Mother Earth, her water and soil.
Over the past centuries, due to population growth and the need for food, and not only in Iran but all over the world, we had to take the water out of the ground, build a variety of dams, and allocate more for the urban and industrial use and less for the agricultural sector. failure to control water consumption patterns in the drinking and industrial sector, locating water-demanding industries such as steel factories away from parts of Iran like the north and the south where we have huge water resources, and instead running them in deserts in central Iran, have all been policies that have jeopardized the country's water balance and water security.
The UN's Food and Agriculture Organization, FAO, is out to help Iran in this regard, while Iran itself is investing in its youth at knowledge-based companies. This is of paramount importance given major water resources have been desiccated by overuse and excessive deep well digging, beginning with the administration past.
We have no choice but to invest in technology and knowledge-based institutions. The sanctions target both our foreign investment and our ability to import the technology we need. The solution is to take steps similar to other countries that have been sanctioned and threatened. They have relied on domestic resources and not on capital and technology coming from abroad.
The role of watershed management and water distribution management in achieving important statistics in the field of agriculture is significant, but there is yet work to be done. FAO has a project to implement in Iran to assist this country in rehabilitating its soil and water resources and enhancing the resilience of the agriculture system and rural communities, resilience to climate change and climatic disasters. Now, two important water resources to replenish are the Qazvin Plain and Urmia Lake Basin. A prerequisite to doing so is water accounting and mapping evapotranspiration. Water accounting is the process of collecting, analyzing, summarizing, and reporting water-related information. It reveals how water is used across different sectors and helps shape and understand the benefits and existing trade-off of the water allocations and use patterns. And the integrated and cross-sectoral presentation of the information on water accounting helps users, that's decision-makers, see the bigger picture. It is important to assess and map agroecological zones and water availability to develop appropriate crop patterns. The development and implementation of different crop patterns contributes to higher land productivity, in other words, increased crop production.
We have several points of view in the Agriculture Commission. One is why, for example, the main livestock feed in our country should be corn, which we can't grow inside Iran. There are plants and fodder that can be grown anywhere without special care in our country, which has a hot and dry climate. We must have an approach toward non-dependency on some inputs. It's not like we make a decision this year and reap the rewards next year. But we can make the right decisions for the coming years, which I think will have a positive outcome.
It is noteworthy as far as self-sufficiency in production and supply goes, the matter of comparative advantage shouldn't be overlooked, hard as that may be with sanctions in place. Because to produce all one needs will in the long term only exhaust the infrastructure to produce agricultural requirements more than it already has. All matters considered, it's the farmer that has to put theory into practice. Our farmer, who is young, unlike a great many, has also, thanks to his college education, fully mechanized his plantation.
In lots of aspects, they are different. One of them is that we have a 7-meter height, and everything is controlled by the smart climate control system, which helps us to use less people to help us, and we are doing these kind of things by hand in the other farms, but in this farm everything is automatically done.
FAO is holding an e-learning program in Iran to equip experts with the knowledge and skills to implement REWAS, REWAS. That's the advanced approach of real water savings. The approach uses the concept of following the water. Given this concept, drainage, runoff, and percolation to the underground are no longer losses, because downstream users can use these recoverable waters. This beauty spot is going to make sure to keep the flow of golden wheat and green bell peppers and red bell peppers going. There's always going to be those who'll make sure of that against all odds. Thanks, bye for now.
Made in Israel. The weapon that was used in nuclear scientist assassination was made in Israel. Mohsen Fakhrizadeh was targeted on Friday, November 27th, in Absad city of Damavand County in the province of Tehran. Iran says that nuclear scientist assassinated east of Tehran province was shot by a remote-controlled machine gun operating out of another car. The weapon collected from the site of the terrorist act bears the logo and specifications of the Israeli military industry. Israel has had a big part to play in the assassination of Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. Israeli media said that a senior Israeli official told the US-based New York Times that the world should thank Israel for killing the Iranian nuclear scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. Apparently, this anonymous official was reportedly involved in the program to track Fakhrizadeh for years. Fakhrizadeh's name was mentioned multiple times in a presentation in 2018 by Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, during which he repeated baseless claims about the Iranian nuclear program. Netanyahu claimed that Israel stole thousands of secret documents on Iran's nuclear energy program. Netanyahu claimed that the nuclear scientist had notably worked from 1999 to 2003 on a secret military project called Ahmad. The aim, according to Netanyahu, was ultimately to produce five nuclear warheads in violation of Iran's international commitments. But under pressure from the United States, which had just invaded Iraq, the Islamic Republic had decided to end it. Iran said the whole presentation was fiction. Netanyahu, nonetheless, described the scientist as the director of Iran's nuclear program and threatened, remember that name, Fakhrizadeh.
Dr. Fakhrizadeh, and also, not coincidentally, many of Sepahan's key personnel worked under Fakhrizadeh. This is how Dr. Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, head of Project Ahmad, put it. Remember that name, Fakhrizadeh.
Moreover, an unnamed Western intelligence source told Channel 12 the killing of the nuclear physicist was the pinnacle of Israel's long-term plans. Iranian Secretary of the Supreme National Security Council Ali Shamkhani says the MKO terrorist group was suspected alongside Israel in the killing of Fakhrizadeh. The enemy, according to Shamkhani, was targeting the Iranian nuclear scientist for decades. Israeli Energy Minister Yuval Steinitz told Israel's Kan public broadcaster that the assassination of Fakhrizadeh was a positive thing for the world. The assassination in Iran, whoever did it, it serves not only Israel, but the whole region and the world, Steinitz said. So far, Tel Aviv has not officially took claim for the attack. But there has been little formal comment from Israeli officials on the assassination. In a video uploaded to Twitter shortly after news of the assassination emerged, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, counting off various achievements of the week, noted that this was a partial list, as I can't tell you everything. It's all for you, citizens of Israel, for our country. It's a week of achievements, and there'll be more. According to Israel Channel 12, all Israeli embassies around the world are on high alert. Francis LePointe International wrote that an Iranian expert who wishes to remain anonymous said that this is a very sophisticated attack on the part of Israel involving no less than 12 attackers. The information was given by the Mossad, who instructed the Iranians, members of the People's Mujahideen Organization, MKO terrorist group, to carry out the mission on the ground, according to the same source. He's referring to the MKO terrorist organization that has assassinated tens of thousands of Iranians since the victory of the Islamic Revolution in 1979 in Iran. Iran says that Israeli intelligence were behind it. The New York Times confirms this, citing unnamed sources. According to the New York Times, one American official, along with two other intelligence officials, said that Israel was behind the attack on the scientist. Many things have been revealed in this assassination. Israeli and European newspapers were flooded with leaked reports confirming that the Mossad-affiliated Kidon assassination unit had a list of assassination operations at the top. This includes Sayed Hassan Nasrallah, the Secretary General of Lebanon's Hezbollah resistance movement. The list allegedly includes member of the Lebanese, Palestinian, Iraqi and Yemeni targets. The Israeli Mossad, in cooperation with its internal mercenaries in Lebanon, has not stopped its attempt to assassinate Sayed Hassan Nasrallah. But all these attempts have failed due to the security vigilance of his security apparatus. The British newspaper The Sunday Times confirmed that the details of the assassination that targeted Professor Fakhrizadeh and the use of the executed cell on motorcycles bear the fingerprints of the Israeli Kidon assassination unit. Raz Zimt, researcher specializing in Iran at the Institute for National Security Studies, INSS, in Tel Aviv, told the New York Times that only Israel and the U.S. have the capacity and the interest to do such a thing, Israel or the United States or both. If this was an Israeli hit, then surely it wasn't the first time. Raz Zimt also says that this situation worries Israel, which is trying to delay Iran's nuclear program, as we saw this summer at the Natanz power plant. On July 2nd, a huge explosion hit a center housing modern centrifuges at this uranium enrichment complex in central Iran. Well, one thing is for sure, Iran will not stop its nuclear energy activities. This is one of Iran's responses to this assassination. In fact, a bill requiring Iran's government to step up uranium enrichment cleared its first hurdle in parliament. Iran's nuclear energy program is already advanced, and this assassination won't do anything in terms of hampering Iran's efforts. It only further exposed Iran's enemies and how far they would go to jeopardize the security of their countries with the aim of ulterior motives.
IRIB English Radio.